K2 Romeo. K2 Romeo, India Whiskey here. At net time, we've already got the Joe WHRYY checked in. The main purpose of the TechNet, you guys have heard sit down many times, is that the curious amateurs get here and teach each other what they've learned about this radio wireless equipment. One of the things I've been forgetting to mention over the last few months, is the recordings of the TechNet. You can look at past recordings of the TechNet for about 10 years worth, maybe even more, by going to amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor. Mike Perry, KC2NJI, runs that particular website that records them all quite often with the help of Roy, AC2GS, when interference is received over there in New Jersey where Mike lives. Another TechNet compatible website is LimarcTechNet.com. LIMARC TechNet.com. And that's by Mike number two, K1MJM, who supplies at that website charts, graphs, photographs, and whatever relevant to the TechNet. So, by way of amateurradio.tv, a few days after now, even this net will be recorded and you can play it there. TechNet, as you know, let me drop. It's broken up into roughly three sections. The first section, people sign in because they do have a question or a comment for the net. They give us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment. That runs for about an hour or so, sometimes longer, if there's enough enthusiasm and enough questions. The next session is by Dr. Roy, AC2GS, which is a science talk, and a mailbag. People who have a question and don't yet have the right license to be able to talk to us directly on the air. And the third section is by Paul, WS2N, who gives us a space report. And lots of new spacecraft are being created, new ways of getting astronauts to the International Space Station and eventually to the moon are in progress, and we'll hear the details of that. So at this time, we're going to take check-ins for people who do have a question or comment. Give me your call letters and name. Try to remember to give me your name. Wait for the beeps also. If we don't wait for the beeps in between transmissions, we might be timing out the machine. So we've got Joe so far. Anyone else to check in tonight with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
WB2GXM, Rich, and yes.
Beautiful, Rich. Okay. Anyone else? So far, we've got Joe and Rich. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N, with a question this week. Good evening, Dick.
Glad to hear that, Paul. Okay, Paul's got a question. And, alrighty. And one last call. Anyone with any questions or comments for the net, give me your call letters right now. And with your name. K2RIW listening. Okay, maybe there's none. And let me check if I got the frequency right here. Yes, I do. Okay, Joe, W2RYY, go easy with us because sometimes you've got some pretty good questions that get us going for a while. Go ahead, Joe. K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You got it, Joe.
Okay, I'm making this line. Here we go. Thank you, Dick, W2RYY. My question has to do with heating assistance, specifically the one I have in my home. I have an old boiler. It's a Whale McLean. It's called a 68. That's one of the numbers on it. P68WT. It's developed a leak where it leaks water out of one of the loops inside for the heat for the house, not the hot water for domestic hot water, but the heating zones. I had to shut the valve off, so I basically don't have any heat in the house. I'm using another source of heat to, you know, keep the house somewhat warm. But is this a repairable type of thing, or is this the end of life of the boiler and it's got to be replaced? I don't know much about it. I've got plus and minus answers from other people I talked to, but maybe I thought I'd bring the thing up here to see if somebody out there has some expertise. They might know something about it, if it's a repairable thing or not. Back to you, W2YY.
Okay, let's review a little bit. If I understand you correctly, you've got a hot water fired, probably baseboard radiation system with circulator pumps. And also there's a coil in that boiler which heats the domestic water for the faucets. But the boiler itself has got a leak. I presume it's leaking into the heating chamber and then dripping onto the floor after a certain amount of water. So I guess the leak is on the outside of that boiler. Yeah, the main outer container for the boiler holds the water that gets circulated to the baseboard radiation. That's my guess. And so can that outer shell be, can the crack be found? Can it be sealed? And I'm guessing that the chances are slim. I'm guessing that 99% of the time when a repair person runs into that problem, the boiler itself gets replaced. If not the whole darn furnace, depending on its age and whether or not that exact boiler is available. But let's first turn it over to the net. Is anyone out there with heating experience as to how to solve a leak in a boiler where water from a hot water heating system is leaking onto the floor, I presume? Give me a call letters if you've got any information on this one. K2RIW and the TechNet.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
I know a lot of the Wild McLeans, that they have these sectional boilers, you know, so there's a series of them, you know, half a dozen sections maybe, and then there's these push numbers in between, and they're compressed, you know, before they're ever sent to a home. Big commercial jobs, they come in as individual pieces and sometimes put together on a job site. But in a home, of course, it's done in a factory. But that leak, to try to take those apart, you know, I guess theoretically you could do it. You could do it, but the cost would be probably much more than the cost of buying a new boiler. That's my guess. That's what it sounds like. It sounds like someone of the push nipples are probably leaking, or I guess you could have developed a crack in one of the sections. Usually it's like a half a dozen sections, and they're put together like that. You know, to connect each one, you have these, you know, small length pipes, you know, these maybe 3-inch nipples or two-inch nipples for the diameter, and they're squeezed, you know, they're compressed in a factory. So I think it's toast. That's my guess. Back to you, Dick.
Is the boiler made in sections where you can decide how many sections you're going to bolt together with a gasket in between them in order to create a boiler of a particular size? Is that sort of what you're describing, with a long bolt that holds them all together? I may have the wrong picture. Over to you on that one, Paul. K2RIW.
Yeah, and that would be on a smaller version, of course. And bigger version, you'd have these massive rods, you know, going from one end to the other, compressing the whole, you know, everything in one. But, you know, to get a section apart and another section on, especially if it's one on the inside, you know, it sounds like... I've never had anybody come out to do it, you know, I wouldn't know, but just knowing a rough idea how these things are put together, I would say it's probably going to be very costly, you know, probably thousands of dollars to do something like that. Might pay to buy a new one.
There's at least two different places where the leak could be taking place, in the middle of one of the sections that we're talking about, or at the seal in between sections. If it's a seal in between sections, the seal becoming leaky, there might be a way of putting the right kind of juice, so to speak, creating the equivalent of a gasket. So I wonder where the leaks tend to come. If it's a cast iron structure, I guess the leak could be anywhere in between as well as on the edges. So is there the possibility that it's just the gasket in between sections that's doing the leaking? Got a guess on that one, Paul? WS2N? K2RIW.
Yeah, it could be, and he has to make sure that's it. He sounds sure. I had it recently. You know, I wasn't too sure where it was, and then sure enough, it was the domestic coil. The domestic coil failed, and then, you know, domestic pressure is a lot higher than regular pressure. He's probably only running around 12 pounds per square inch in his boiler. And the domestic side, you're running, you know, 50, 55 pounds. So if you have a leak in your domestic coil, that water starts pressurizing. You know, it's going into your existing system, your heating system, and pressurizing that. And then what happens is your relief valve goes. Next thing you know, you have a flood in the basement. You know, that's what happened to me. And, of course, that's fixable because it's an internal coil. And, you know, they come out and they unbolt that internal coil. You know, cut all the pipes and, you know, unbolt the coil, put a new coil in, a new gasket and everything, and then they, you know, resolder everything together. So hopefully that would be the case with him, but he sounds pretty sure that it's one of the sections on a big commercial boiler. They used to call them pork chop boilers. They look like big pork chops, you know. But he's got a domestic boiler. I don't know. You call somebody, get a price, and see what it is. You know, the boiler's going to go for many thousands of dollars. Back to you.
Doesn't the system also have a overflow tank, a tank that's supposed to be filled with air, and the air gets compressed as the water expands when it gets hot, and sometimes that can lose its air and get filled up with water, and therefore build up ridiculous pressure. And I'm hearing some cracklies in the background. Let's see if I can make those cracklies get less. And we got some cracklies tonight. So, isn't there an overflow tank that can be drained to make sure it's got air in it again so that you don't get an overpressure in the boiler? Over to WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, the extrol tank. You know, it's essentially the diaphragm. You've got air on one side and water on the other. And, you know, it's charged with air on one side. And, you know, as the water, you know, water expands and contracts, so the water pushes on the diaphragm. And, you know, this way, you know, you don't blow up your system. If you didn't have that, you know, the water would have nowhere to go and it would, you know, it would break a pipe somewhere. The old they had tanks, you know, they were always located, like, in a closet, the highest part of the house. You know, and they had actual compression tanks. No diaphragm, no you know, nothing like that. You would have a sight glass, you would look at the sight glass, check the water level. Those days are gone, of course, but, you know, I'm sure he's got the extra old tank that he's probably looking at. That's probably not the case, though. If that failed, if that filled up with water, his relief valve would blow. You know, he wouldn't feel like a leak coming from the water. He would see the relief valve open and close, open and close. You know, back to there.
As you can tell, Joe, Paul has got some experience with a leaky boiler, and I don't have I've got a hot air system, not a hot water system, so I don't. As you can tell, we're mostly speculating. And the cracklies we're hearing tonight, I wonder if it's because of the rain that's starting to happen. Static electricity, as opposed to the swaying of the antenna, which did get one big cause of cracklies due to the swaying antenna was essentially cured this week by anti-WA2 CDL, among others. Okay, as you can tell, we haven't got a great deal of information for you, Joe. I know with great difficulty there may be a way to look in there with a mirror and find out where the leak is actually coming from. Sure would be nice if it was in between the sections where the gasket is, and you could cure the gasket with some difficulty. But if it's if the cast iron section, I'm guessing it's cast iron, section itself has got a leak, It doesn't sound encouraging, but as you can tell, we don't really know. A little more search on your part is going to be required. And I presume this happened in the last month or so. W2RYY, E2RAW in the tech van.
Well, actually, what happened, Dick, was this actually happened about a year or two ago. I didn't lose the heat, but, you know, a couple times from, you know, just not paying attention much to the oil level of the tank, I ran it dry, and of course, the burner, you know, exhausted the fuel supply and, you know, shut itself off. And I had cases where it was like 8-10 hours later, I come home, the house is, you know, chilled off. If it's in, like, the winter time, at least once and a half. But I have a puddle on the floor, and I never knew where the water was coming from. People sometimes think, cool off and you get a little space between the gaskets and the fit sometimes as it cools off and they get water can leak that way. So it's happened a few times in the bed, but now it's happening all the time. So I have to valve that feeds the pressure relief valve. I have that valve actually shut off because I leave it on. It'll have a continuous flood of water coming out of the bottom of the boiler after a length of time. What also happens, it makes steam as the boiler actually runs now. So the other water that's going through it, which is not leaking on the floor, it's just the hot water. But because I don't have the other water in the other circulating part of the system, and it must be all, you know, expended completely because of the leak. It takes a long time for the boiler to heat up the other water coil that's in the burner. Actually in the boiler itself, so it's becoming a difficult problem to deal with now that it's getting pretty cold out. I have got prices, and I don't like the prices I've seen so far. Boiler's like approaching $3,000, and about another $2,000 or more to install it. So it's a pretty hefty price tag. So I thought I'd just ask to find out, maybe somebody has some insight on something like this, or it's a repairable thing, or, you know, if the burner's like 30, the burner's approaching 30, boiler's approaching 30 years old, so, you know, people have told me it's like 10 years past its life expectancy anyway. Back to you.
Yeah, that's new information to me, but it makes some sense that the boiler has a finite life due to being made out of, I'm guessing, rustable materials, and it builds up rust, and eventually, and for 20 or so years, that's a failure mechanism of hot water systems that I never even considered, because I've got a hot air system. I wonder what the failure mechanism for my hot air system is. Eventually, I guess the chamber with the fire inside may be developing a crack eventually. I hope that doesn't happen. Anybody have any other information about a leaking boiler? And is there a less expensive repair other than replacing the boiler? And I guess you were quoted $3,000 for the price of the unit and $2,000 to install it. Was that replacing the whole darn furnace or just the boiler section of the furnace? Over to you, Joe. Drag your feet in case anyone else has anything to contribute to this one. From A2RYY with some delay, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, what you call the whole furnace is two pieces independent of each other, even though they work as one. The boiler is where the fire chamber is, and the water is heated in that part there. And then you have a burner, which is where the fuel oil goes into, and it's ignited and burned, and it has a motor and an oil pump on it. I think the price of the boiler was like something like $2,900, something like that. I think it was $2,900 or something like that, and then the burner itself is like about $680 added on to that, and that comes as a unit. But that's neither here nor there, and then it's something like almost another $2,000 to install all this stuff to get that changed. Sounds to me like this is a problem which can't be really repaired. It's not like it's time to bite the bullet. I'm going to have to think about coming up with a way of replacing the boiler. Thanks for entertaining the question. I'll have a better one next week on RF propagation. K2RIW and WH4YY. Thanks.
And WS1 one more time.
Okay. Okay, yeah, Paul with another comment. WS2N, go right ahead, Paul.
When I first moved here, it was a development, sort of built up in inexpensive boilers, you know, they were called Repco. They're gone now, Repcos. And I don't think any of them made it past 5 years. So, you know, a similar type of thing happened with Joe happened. The only good thing was I had the Beckett burner. I'm not sure what burner he has, which was a good burner. So when I put the new boiler in, by the way, Joe, I got a Utica. A Utica is just, it's like, I don't know how many decades I've had this thing. But a Utica is very good. And I like that one. But, you know, the deal is, with a lot of boilers, people want to try to save money. So what they'll do is, if they go, they want to they'll shut it down in the summertime. I'm only going to use the hot water at night. I'll turn it back on at night, let it heat up. That type of thing. Meanwhile, what you're doing is the boiler's contracting and expanding. And similar to what happened with Joe when he ran out of oil, the boiler goes down to ambient temperature. Sometimes they'll start leaking. They like to be happy, to keep it at the same temperature. So all summer long, I'd leave mine at the same temperature. That's it. I need it for hot water anyway. But, you're going to save a buck by shutting it down. But in the long run, you're going to lose a lot more. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's a good point to consider, Paul. The thermal cycling is going to be taking an expandable metal object, so-called boiler, and continuously flexing it. So even though you think you're saving a little bit of money on the oil, it could be false economy, like you said. Oh, well. Do some web searching, for sure, Joe. Complicated things like this, if you do enough web searching, you'll find out what various vendors sell the components and the services for, and that'll give you a clue. I recently had a repaving of a driveway done with asphalt, and I wish I had done some web searching ahead of time to find out what the proper prices are, because I did get overcharged, and I was naive as to what driveway repaving costs are really like. Okay, back to you for any finals, Joe. The B2RYY with a little bit of foot dragging, in case anybody can give us some suggestions on a leaking boiler of a hot water system. B2RYW, over to you, Joe, with some delay.
Okay, Dick, I have no more questions on this subject, unless you want to entertain the other one at the end of the questioning period, or it could be, table for next week, because I think you only had like two check-ins this week, but it's up to you.
Yeah, I'm going to go over to Rich next, and if no one else checks in with any questions, or if they can't tolerate the scratches, then maybe we'll come back to your question. There's B2GXM. Go right ahead, Rich. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is also Rich, or Dick.
Thank you, Dick. K2RIW in the group. WB2GXM. Joe, we feel for you, and I think, Dick, we are both of us envious of your hot air system. But on to my question. I am in a continual quest for an electronic transmit-receive switch for separate receivers and transmitters. And I think I'm about to go bite the bullet and try to build one from an article on a schematic. So this TR switch uses pin diodes, and the pin diodes are reverse biased by 180 volts DC with very, very minimal current. I am a little leery of putting 180 volts DC directly in front of my expensive receiver, and I noticed that the Magic Box TR switch uses FET devices, FET devices. So my question is, can an FET device block 100 watts of RF from 80 through 10 meters from getting to my receiver, WB2GXM.
I wonder if we do enough searches for transmit receive switches that are purely electronic, is what you're describing now, either made out of PIN diodes or made out of FET transistors. If we do enough searching, does anybody claim that they can run at the 100 watt level, 80 through 10 meters? If so, by some means, there may be a way of finding a service manual or whatever to get a schematic of that, and therefore you can build a homebrew version of it. That's one way, or bite the bullet and just buy the darn thing. So, does anybody build a FET transmit receive switch that claims it'll work at the 100 watt level, 80 through 10 meters? So, doing a search to find out what exists. I mean, if there are transistors that'll do it, somebody will have used them. I'm wondering why they put minus, yes, I do know why. The minus 180 volts, if it's a real high voltage pin, becomes an extremely low capacitance. The problem with pins is that when they're forward biased, they give you a nice low resistance and they're conducting the signal for you. When you want to non-conduct the signal, you put a reverse bias on it. But in order for the pin diode to have the lowest possible capacitance, you want the highest voltage on it. More voltage in reverse direction on a diode gives you a lower capacitance. And so until you get the capacitance down to the absolute minimum, the capacitive coupling on the pin represents a sneak pass by which some RF still gets through, and you don't have as much isolation as you'd like. Let's see now, there was another thing I was going to mention. Do you think anybody makes a... obviously, people do make FET transistor transmit receive switch assemblies, but are the ones you can buy only at the 10-watt level, so to speak? Does anybody make one at the 100-watt level? Over to you for any possible answers on that one, Rich, and do as much web searching as you can before committing to a particular brand name and schematic and whatever. WB2GXM, K2RIW, you got it, Rich.
I got a bunch of questions, WHCDL, because I have a few of these.
Okay, let's find out what you've got. Are they made out of FET? Do they run at high power? And maybe yours are all diodes type as opposed to transistors. WB2CDL, commercial driver's license, K2RIW, you got it, Andy. And by the way, I'm wondering if the scratchies tonight are due to the rain, you know, precipitation status, as opposed to wind. You got it, Andy.
Well, it's not raining by me, and I have clear skies, so I'm not sure. Rich, give me just a few bits of information. What's the receiver using? What's the transmitter using? When you say it's electronic, does that mean you don't want to use any relays at all to switch your 100 watts? Those are three basic questions right now. Go ahead, Rich. GXM.
Thank you, Andy. Good to talk to you again tonight. Well, in the specific situation would be the transmitter is a Heathkit DX60B, and I'm sure that runs somewhere between 40 to 70 watts output. The receiver would be either a DX150A, a realistic DX160, an ICOM R71A, or a couple of other miscellaneous receivers. And I'm looking for a purely electronic, no relays. I got plenty of relays. I got plenty of leads on relays and relay-based TR switches. No, want a purely electronic. This is the holy grail thing. WB2GXM.
Dual little vacuum.
Yeah, a quick question on this one. You're against electromechanical relays. Is it because of the switching speed, or you're afraid of wear out? Or maybe you want to run full break-in, and therefore you want as fast a switching as possible. So what's the reason you don't like electromechanical relays, Rich? GXM, RIW?
Well, there's a certain finite life to them, and I I'm looking for a full QSK. This might be pie in the sky, and I'm sure I could just have it, have a modern transceiver and have it done with it. So that's where I'm going.
I gotta jump out of the car, but I was gonna ask that question, why? And it's still a big why for me. Do me a favor, can you email me your phone number, Rich, and I'll call you on the phone, and I'll tell you what I did, and it's very easy to do. That DX60 already has provisions for what you're talking about, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. So that's why I'm mentioning it. You wanna, can you just email me with your phone number, and I'll call you back, all right, tomorrow, all right, because I just got to the store, I got to jump out of the car, or walk out of the car, go ahead.
I don't think you should keep it a secret, Andy. I think to discuss what you did on the air is great. I know that you're at the store now and you want to do some shopping, and maybe you'll be back in 15 minutes after that shopping, and you can give us the rest of the story. Over to you, CDL, K2IW.
Yeah, when I get done, I'll come back. All right, when I want to go into the store because they close early. So I'm going to go in now, and I'll be back later. WA2CDL.
Out of curiosity, does everybody know your email address? This is WA2CDL at ARRL.net.
Verizon.net, Verizon.
Okay, your call letters at Verizon.net. That's the that's your email address?
That is.
Okay, yes. For those who have never heard of, what do they call it now, full break-in, it is possible to have, it could be done electromechanically, but people love to do it electronically. In other words, in between the dots and dashes when you're sending Morse code, whenever the key is up, the system is fast enough to go back into the receive mode. Therefore, while you're sending Morse code, it's almost like having full duplex. In other words, in between your key up positions when you're sending Morse code, if the person wants to say something to you, ask you to, hey, repeat that last sentence, he can start sending you Morse code during the time your key is up. You hear it and know to stop sending and then listen to his message. That's what full break-in is. But to be flipping your electromechanical relay for every dot and dash, you can see how you would worry about wearing out those contacts and wearing out the whole assembly. To make it purely electronic is a nicer way to go. And by the way, the 180 volts on pin diodes, there's a way to protect yourself from that one, Rich, and that is to have capacitive coupling into the receiver, but make sure the receiver side of that capacitive coupling has an RF choke from center conductor to ground on the coaxial cable. With an RF choke, none of the voltage on the pin diode can get into the receiver. And if the receiver is made with a tube front end, it can tolerate it. But yeah, most receivers nowadays have got a solid state front end. And by way of an RF choke, you can make sure the DC voltage doesn't get there. WB2GXM for any of the above. K2RIW.
Oh, sure, with a tube receiver, the problem basically is solved with an EF Johnson TR switch. Just get one of those and you're done. Tubes can handle that, but I'm going to be using this with solid-state receivers, and therein is the problem. But it's not a big problem because it's not an emergency. I mean, you know, I could all, like I said, we just fire up a transceiver with built-in QSK and I'm not done with it. This is just, you know, the project, like people will build their own Yagis, people will build their own loops instead of buying one. So that's where I'm going. And I appreciate all the help, Andy. I will email you. And you can go back to Joe if you want to for the propagation thing. WB2GXM.
Yeah, we're probably going to go back to Joe. But first, Rich, even though your solid state front end cannot tolerate voltage, with an RF choke on the receiver side, none of the DC voltage can get there with a reasonable RF choke. And a solid-state front end has a transistor in the front end that can be blown if high voltage goes into it. But that's not the end of the world. For people who build super low-noise preamplifiers for moon bounce, some kind of a minor glitch is going to always create a problem with that low noise amplifier, and they're replacing that transistor. So when DC voltage goes into a solid state receiver, that very first transistor can be damaged. But replacing that very first transistor usually is not a big deal. It's an inconvenience, but to worry about DC voltage getting there, if you weren't using the RF choke, it won't get there with the RF choke, but even if it does, replacing that transistor is all that can go. You pour DC voltage into a solid state receiver, it doesn't wipe out the whole receiver. It just damages that first transistor. And that first transistor is inductively coupled or capacitively coupled to the next stage. And so the high voltage doesn't get to the second stage. You're only blowing out one transistor, which is replaceable. And maybe we're worrying too much too soon. I mean, a brave man dies but once. A non-brave man dies many times, worries about things that are not going to happen, or if they do happen, it's not a big deal to fix it. You see what I'm saying on that one, Rich? WB2GXM, K2RIW.
Do you have a ballpark figure in millihenries for that choke at 3 to 30 megahertz?
Yes. 3 to 30 megahertz. At 3 megahertz, you'd like the RF choke to at the lowest frequency where the choke is going to have the least amount of inductive reactance. Make sure that the choke has enough microhenries so that it has, let me pick a number, 50 ohms of reactance or more. 50 ohms of shunt reactance at 80 meters will give you a half a dB or a quarter of a dB of signal loss, but all the signals on 80 meters start off so loud. I mean, just the noise in the background at 80 meters is so loud that if you lose half a dB of sensitivity in the receiver, you would never know the difference. So choose the right amount of reactance, microhenries, so that it's a 50 ohm reactance or a little bit more at 3 megacycles, and then it's going to be a 500 ohm reactance at 30 megacycles automatically, 10 times higher in frequency. So that tells you how many microhenries, and by way of the coil, by way of the equation that you've got in the radio amateur's handbook, it'll tell you what diameter of coil, how many turns, and you plug in the numbers, it'll tell you what reactance you're going to get. Or you can buy an inductor of the right number of microhenries ahead of time. But that's the way you could homebrew the coil. So that's the way I would do it. And an inductor reactance of 50 ohms on a 50 ohm resistor receiver is very little signal loss. And at 80 meters, you can tolerate an awful lot. I mean, the noise background on 80 meters is equivalent to a 40 dB noise figure. And if you've got instead of a 3 dB noise figure, you got a 3.5 dB noise figure in the receiver, you would never know the difference. You see what I'm saying on that one, Rich? The V2GXM, K2RIW in the tech net.
You are awesome. WB2GXM.
There's a man who appreciates an answer. People worry about inductor reactance. Very few of us have done an overall impedance calculation of a 50 ohm resistor, which is the receiver or the transmitter in theory. And if you now put a 10 ohm, a 50 ohm, or a 500 ohm inductive reactance across that resistor, what's the new impedance and how much signal gets through? Very few people have done that calculation. No one here is difficult as you think. And so now you know a ballpark figure as to how to do it. Already, so you know a schematic, or you've already got one with pin diodes that go to 180 volts. Do you own one of those 180 volt transmit receive switches, or you're about to buy or build one? And what's the highest power FET transmit receive switch you've ever heard of? Give me whatever you know on those two subjects, Rich. WB2GXM, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, I've been searching for a commercial unit for a few years now, 2, 3, 4 years. Nobody makes one. Nobody makes a true, purely electronic TR switch. And the only effective TR switch that I've ever seen was the QRP guy's kit, the magic box. That is only good up to 10 watts. And I actually have two of them. So I actually... actually have the only commercially marketed electronic TR switch available. The Magic Box uses FETs to shunt the signal to ground and also disconnect the receiver during transmit. It does not use pin diodes.
The one that does not use pin diodes, is that the one that uses FET transistors? Is that what you're saying, Rich?
Yes, it uses FET transistors on the receiver side. It has four FET transistors, two of them during transmit, two of them shunt the signal to ground, and two of them disconnect the receiver from the line. It uses other components to make sure that the transmit signal goes to the antenna and not to the receiver circuitry. That's what the FETs do. They don't have to, FETs in that circuit do not have to deal with transmit power.
Yeah, in the old days, the amount of power you could put into a FET was kind of limited, although they're getting better these days. When it comes to full break-in, people who send Morse code where they can, during the time the key is up, hear whether or not the other guy you're talking to is sending a signal to you, saying, please repeat the last sentence. People have been doing full break-in for lots and lots of years, and I can't believe that all the people doing full break-in were only QRP people. I'd like to believe some of those people were running higher power. So maybe it's a homebrew circuit, or maybe it's a commercial brand that no longer exists, but people have done full break-in. If you do a whole lot of searches on full break-in and find the guys with high power full break-in, that might give you some clues as to what they used. And even if you can just get the call letters of somebody who has done it, and if he's not a silent key, you send him a message and ask him where did the circuit schematic come from. The moonbounce people don't do full break-in, but the moonbounce people do use super low-noise transistors that are delicate, and they do worry about the transmitter and receiving from the same antenna and make sure that the receiver is isolated when they're transmitting. And you'd like to have the transmitter somewhat isolated when you're receiving so you're not losing a noise figure on the end of the receiver. So I'm pretty sure, though, with the RF choke on the receiver side, you're going to protect that first stage of the receiver. And even if it's not fully protected for whatever reason, the replacing that first transistor, if you do damage it, is not as big a deal as you think. If you're a crafty guy, and you sound like you're a crafty guy that could get in there and do that. Back to you for any final comments on any of the above, though, Rich. WB2GXM, K2RIW.
WH4YY would comment on this subject.
Oh, let's pick up Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. A place this that Rich may check out, I don't know if they make it for ham use. I know they make electronic switches for commercial use, and the switches they make will handle a lot of RF power, something like approaching about 2 kilowatts. Try checking out Hill Engineering up in northern Massachusetts. I think they're up near Boston, possibly. Hill Engineering up in around the Boston, Massachusetts area. Try looking for them. They may not make what you're looking for, but you can, you know, certainly Google their name and find out what they do make. Back to you.
Joe, how did you find out about Hill Engineering? And is it a high-power component we're talking about, pin or FET, or are these complete assemblies doing a transmit-receive function? So what's the product that you believe Hill has? How did you find out about it? B2RYY, K2RYW.
If you would have answered my email, I would have told you that, but I'm not going to get into it on the radio. But anyway, I don't know specifically if they make what you're looking for, and I'm familiar with some of their products, okay? That's all I'm going to go into right now.
Very fine, Joe. Okay, you're familiar with their products. So let's see if Rich has any fill required on this one. And Hill Engineering, I guess they've got a website, so that's how he's going to be able to get their address and or phone number. To B2G GXM for any final, K2RIW.
Hill Engineering, got it. Thank you, Joe. I'll be emailing Andy, and the trail continues, and I appreciate all the help, Dick. K2RIW, WB2GXM.
Sometimes, Rich, all it takes is a little morsel of information, and away you go.
It's worth a try, and what was I going to say? Yeah, more people would be using full break-in if they had a feeling, if they had a warm and fuzzy feeling for what it is and how much fun. There are a number of people who sign into the TechNet really love Morse code. Among the Morse code lovers, those who have the next level of sophistication of Morse code, CW, where they can do full break-in, where they can hear what's going on during the short periods of time that the key is up between the dots and the dashes, to hear what's going on in the background, it's very nice to have. And so more people would be doing it if they understood it. So therefore, as you discover more about this particular project of yours, a beautiful project, Rich, keep us informed as to what you find out so that other people can possibly do it if they want to. Changing subjects now, N2ION, Jeff and I have had some conversations on email over the last couple of days, and so Jeff has a darn good subject that he could bring to the TechNet tonight if he's available. But before we pick up with Jeff, let's go back to Joe, because Joe's got a propagation question. W2RYY, K2RIW, TechNet. You've got it, Joe.
Okay, batter up. I have a fellow ham that lives near me who I've been friends with for a long time. We did some tests on hams. Actually, did curiosity, because I've talked to him on HF directly on several various bands. And some bands, as he goes on, the signal level is increased, is very, very strong. So actually, the other night, I had him give me a CW carrier, no voice modulation, all to be able to measure with good, fairly good accuracy at a specific frequency with me coming in from a specific antenna. I use my spectrum analyzer as a receiving element, okay, to read the, you know, pretty much absolute level within its accuracy. Now, I use two different antennas on receive. This guy's got a, I think I called it Alpha Delta DX series antenna. It resembles a dipole, for lack of better terms. 60-degree slope, I think, on most of his wiring. And I'm not on the end of his dipole. I'm sort of like, not broadside, but like at a 45-degree angle to him. He lives less than about a mile away from me, maybe a little less than a mile. But here's some levels I recorded off of two different antennas. The first antenna I used was an Antron 99, which is a fiberglass version, type of version antenna that covers from 10 meters down to about, safely say it covers to 20 meters with an antenna tuner. But I use that, and I use a long wire on the other stuff lower than that. So on a long wire antenna, start at the lowest frequency, going through the antenna tuner and tuning to the best carrier level coming in. I can see the level come up as I tune the antenna tuner. On 80 meters, bottom end of the band, up to 80 meters, he come in with a minus 30 dBm signal. He's running 100 watts into his antenna. At 40 meters, he was minus 46. 20 meters, he was minus 78. Now, that's listening off the Antron, which is vertically polarized. My long wire is horizontally polarized. 17 meters, minus 84. 15 meters, minus 66. At 10 meters, minus 80. Why is it such a variation? What's going on here, Dick? Back to you.
Yeah, this is a good one. I hear the trend that, in general, the higher frequencies have weaker signals. You go from minus 40 all the way down to minus 80 at the highest frequency, minus 40 at the lower frequency. So your signals are getting weaker as you get higher in frequency. And so if I had an anechoic chamber, which is the ideal setup, as opposed to you and your buddy, let me pick a number, he maybe is 3 miles away, and you got a bunch of terrain in between, which makes things a little bit more complicated. But even if you had an ideal anechoic chamber, and you got a transmitter and a bunch of antennas at one end of the chamber, and you're receiving set up with a bunch of antennas at the other end. So you got a fixed distance inside of an ideal anechoic chamber, a large room with no echoes. So now nothing but the free space signal is getting there. You will find that with near unity gain antennas, in other words, within a couple of dB of 0 dB over isotropic, or maybe 5 dB over isotropic antennas. So you got antennas that are near 0 dB of gain on both transmitting and receiving. Gain is 4 pi A over lambda squared. If I solve that for area, area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. Gain lambda squared over 4 pi. You'll notice that as you go higher in frequency, the lambda is getting into the wavelength is getting into a smaller number, and you're squaring it. And lambda squared is the main ingredient for area. So every higher frequency antenna of the same gain has a smaller capture area. So near unity gain on transmit, no matter what you use for a transmitter, no matter what band you're on, it's near isotropic. It's a light bulb in a spherical room, sending signals out in all directions. So the amount of signal strength you're sending out is the same, but the amount you receive is weaker and weaker, because as you go up in frequency, the same antenna gain is a smaller antenna. You know, your whip antenna or your dipole antenna gets smaller when you go to the higher frequencies. It's common sense that the antenna has got less area. Less area at higher frequencies means that you're getting a smaller percentage of all that signal lighting up the spherical room, if you know what I mean, and you're going down to a smaller number of square meters of the receiving area, and you're going to get a weaker signal. Therefore, if you've got the same gain on transmit and receive, and you hold it constant as you go to various frequencies, the signal strength will fall off by 1 over frequency squared because of the lambda squared portion of the formula. So higher frequencies by frequency squared phenomena, 1 over frequency squared, is the signal strength you're going to get as you go up in frequency when you're keeping the antenna gains constant even though you're changing the frequency. Does that make some sense, Joe? The V2RYY is the way it should be.
Repeater, timeout.
Repeater. Was I cut off or something? Is somebody playing games, turning this thing on and off?
Hello, 1-2. Okay. The repeater just came on in the last couple of seconds. We have to wait until it gives an announcement that the timeout is over. Your whole transmission, I was hearing you on the input. You were not coming through the machine because you were just giving, your transmission was not allowing the thing to reset. Once you get a timeout in this machine, there has to be no signal on the input for quite a period of time for it to reset. So please repeat your last transmission. I heard it on the input. Very few other people heard it. Therefore, it wasn't coming through the machine. And so we have to make sure we listen for the beeps in between. We've been cutting off that time, if you know what I mean. So repeat your last transmission, Joe, to B2RYY. Environment between you and your buddy 3 miles away is my guess. even though you might be horizontal and a particular antenna and he might be vertical, his antenna might be vertical on that particular frequency, that almost doesn't matter, because by the time the signal reflects off all of the jazz that's in your environment, the horizontal doesn't stay horizontal, the vertical doesn't stay vertical. So cross-polarization adds some number dB of extra loss in the system, but does not kill the signal. It may knock the signal down by 5 dB, not 50 dB. So cross-polarization is a red herring. Don't let that confuse you. In an anechoic chamber with exactly right angle between the antennas, horizontal and vertical, you'll see a deep null. In an anechoic chamber only. In the real environment, you don't see that. But except for that red herring of horizontal versus vertical, the trends on the numbers you gave me, you're getting a weaker signal at the higher frequencies. The higher frequencies, by definition, the same gain as a much smaller area by a 1 over frequency squared phenomena. That accounts for the major factor of the signal getting weaker. So when you go from 3 megs to 30 megs, a 10 to 1 frequency ratio, and it's frequency squared phenomena, it's 100, so the signal, by calculation, should be 20 decibels weaker at 10 meters versus 80 meters because of effective capture area. It should be 20 dB weaker. So that's part of the factors of those signal strengths you've seen between the minus 40 and the minus 80. WH2RYY, K2RIW, wait for the beeps.
Okay, you said 3 miles away. This guy's less than a mile away from me. He's not 3 miles away. Like, I would say less than a mile in linear distance. And I got more than a 20 dB spread between 3 meg and 30 meg, approximately. I got a 50 decibels change. It's minus 30 on 80 meters. It's minus 80 on 10 meters. So you're saying it should be a 20 dB difference because of the frequency change? I'm seeing much, much more than that.
Okay, 1 mile versus 3 miles, that's a minor factor, Joe. In 1 mile of terrain around your house, you got lots of trees, buildings, water towers, radio, you got all kinds of jazz. So polarization doesn't get maintained. And of the weaker signal you're getting, you said as much as 50 dB of difference between 3 megs and 80 meg and 30 megs. 20 dB of it is explainable. The other 30 dB is not explainable. And each of your antennas, any number of feet above the ground, you're getting multipath, you're getting ground reflection. Sometimes the ground reflected signal and the signal through the air are 180 degrees out of phase at certain frequencies for certain heights of antennas. So that's another factor. So, and by the way, you said you made these measurements on a spectrum analyzer. That's a good way to go. I'm guessing the spectrum analyzer might be the spectrum analyzer function of your service monitor. I'm not sure, but you're going to correct me. I'm not sure you've got a completely separate machine by Enritzo or Hewlett-Packard or Tektronix that is a standalone spectrum analyzer. I'm guessing it's the spectrum analyzer function of your service monitor. W-H-R-Y-Y-K-2-R-I-W.
Yes, Dick, that's what I'm using. I'm using the spectrum analyzer portion of my service monitor set at 20 kilohertz per horizontal division, I guess 20 kilohertz per centimeter, to get the best resolution of a single carrier. And its accuracy at 3 meg compared to 30 meg, I can put the same level in, and the spectrum analyzer reads the same within maybe about a half a dB or so. So it's very good as far as its logarithmic response from one end of the band to the other. So I know that my test equipment is working properly, or we're pretty close to it. So you think 20 dB is accountable by your formula, and the other 30 dB on the higher frequency is maybe explainable by signal simply being out of phase by him receiving a partial sky wave and a partial ground wave and getting some cancellation?
That was my first guess. I suddenly realized I made a math error. The effective capture area in square meters goes down by frequency squared. Let me think about that. No. It's worse than that. The dimensions of your receiving area, you've got one-tenth the width and one-tenth the height when you go to the higher frequency. But that is 1/10 the area. 1/100 the area. 1/100 the area is 20 dB. I was thinking it's 1/100 the voltage, which means it's 40 dB, but no, it's 20 dB. Oh, well. So we can explain 20 dB of it, of the 80 dB difference you see.